This episode of Women with Balls is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Ball, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today has had an unexpected path into politics. Born and raised in West Yorkshire, she started her career in the furniture industry before retraining and pursuing a career in health and fitness. Her life changed forever when her sister, the MP Jo Cox, was murdered by a right-wing extremist during the 2016 Brexit referendum campaign. Thrust into the public eye, she became a voice for unity across politics, helping to found the Jo Cox Foundation and the More in Common Initiative, and she's been awarded an MBE for her work on social cohesion. 5 years later, in 2021, she was elected as a Labour MP in a by-election in the constituency her sister had served, and she was also named the Spectator's Newcomer of the Year. More recently, she has been the face of the campaign to legalise assisted dying following her autumn private members bill. Currently making its way through the parliamentary process, it has been described as the biggest social reform in a generation. My guest today is Kim Leadbeater. Kim, delighted to have you in the Spectator offices today. Is this your first time over here?
It is. It's very posh, isn't it? It's lovely though.
It's quite period. Yeah, more than these open plan offices you get these days. Now to begin, we always ask the same question, which is, was yours a happy childhood?
A really happy childhood, I think it's fair to say, Katie. Yeah, I was really lucky. I had two wonderful parents, an amazing sister, lovely grandparents and a wider family, lots of friends. And I've got nothing but happy memories, really, of, you know, being a kid growing up in Yorkshire. Lots of fun, lots of love. Yeah, and I've valued that more and more over the years.
People from Yorkshire have a lot of love from Yorkshire. I like visiting Yorkshire. What do you think it is that, how would you define the Yorkshire spirit?
I mean, I'm incredibly proud to be a Yorkshire woman. And there is a real sense of identity. There's a real sense of belonging. There's also a really important sense of telling it like it is. You know, we don't take any nonsense. And I just think that sort of northern grit and determination to get stuff done. But we're also really friendly people as well. And it's interesting, having done this job for a few years now, someone will always have a connection to Yorkshire. Or wherever meeting I go to and whatever event I attend, someone will know somebody from Yorkshire. And it's always a really nice feeling to have those conversations with people.
Because Rishi Sunak has a Yorkshire constituency. Did you have, obviously he's still around, but do you have some solidarity with your fellow Yorkshire MPs, even if they're different parties?
Yeah, no, I think so. In fact, I was in the voting lobby with Rishi Sunak last night. I think we were voting on the tobacco and vapes bill. And it's always nice to do cross-party things. Yeah, and I think regionally, there's a sense of identity with MPs, like you say, whichever party they represent.
Now, growing up in your family, was politics something that was discussed much? Because you went on to study philosophy and politics, I think I'm correct to say.
Yeah, well, I did. I didn't finish that course. It was during my sort of teenage years and I was still trying to work out what my path in life was. But I started doing a degree in philosophy and politics. Yeah, but no, I mean, it wasn't. I wouldn't say we definitely weren't a politically active family, but we were always very people focused. And actually what I've come to appreciate over the years is that politics is about people and fundamentally helping people. And or if it isn't, that's what it should be about. So mum and dad sort of instilled in us a really core set of values about how you treat other people and respect. And I've got a real interest in people and people's circumstances and lives. So, you know, my mum and dad were not involved in politics, but we were always thinking about how people lived and, you know, social issues, I would say, rather than necessarily political.
So was there a sense that you were Labour or that you're more likely to be Labour than not or from the left, or was that not so clear?
I never really thought in those terms. And to be honest,
no, some people don't.
To some degree, I still don't really. Yeah. You know, I am a values-driven person and therefore a values-driven politician. And where that puts me politically is probably, you'd say, somewhere in the centre ground, I would guess. But I will always do what I think is right on a particular issue rather than necessary through an ideological lens.
And you mentioned obviously dropping out of that course. What was it that made you leave? I studied single honours philosophy. What did you dislike more, the philosophy or the politics? Or was it just something else caught your eye?
I think it was more that I wasn't really ready. I wasn't really ready to go to university. Yeah. So I left school and I'd had an interesting sort of journey through sort of studying my A-levels. Jo, my sister, had been to Cambridge University and there was a bit of pressure on me to go to Cambridge or Oxford and do the same thing. And I was a bit of a rebel. And I thought, I'm not doing what people tell me to do. I'm going to do my own path. So I actually worked for a few years and then I went back to uni. And I just really wasn't ready for it. And I think sometimes we're pushed into making decisions very early on in our lives. And that doesn't work for everybody. You know, at 16 and 18, you're making really fundamental life decisions. So I actually ended up going back to university when I think I was 25, picking a subject that I really cared about and was really passionate about. And that worked much better for me.
So of the sibling dynamic, were you the slightly less academic one? Or was that the wrong way to put it? I just wanted to, because obviously, if your sister goes to Oxford, it does set a bit of a bar, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it did. No, we were both very similar, both academic, but also both sporty, both very social, very, very similar in lots of ways, actually. And as much as Jo went to Cambridge traditionally at the age of 18, I mean, she had a very tough time there, and fair play to her for sticking it out because it was challenging. But I'd sort of seen that, and I thought, that isn't really for me. That isn't, you know, where I want to be. But no, we were both sort of, I would say, pretty well-rounded, as indeed Jo's kids are now, sporty and academic and interested in lots of different things.
Now, I obviously want to talk about your political career, but just briefly for listeners on our time-limited podcast, can you talk us through your career until we get to the event, the change in that introduction?
Yeah, I suppose I'd done lots of things with my life before Jo was killed. So I'd worked in a laboratory in a carpet yarn manufacturing business. I had worked selling beds in the furniture industry. I worked my way up quite quickly to become a national account manager, covering businesses across the whole of the UK. And then, as I say, I went back to university. And then I found my real passion, Katie, which is about health and well-being. And that's something I've tried to bring into politics. Holistic health and well-being, so physically being well, mental health, social health and connection, what our communities look like, so individuals, but more at a community level as well. And that was my real passion. So I did lots of things. I was a lecturer because I trained to be a teacher as well. And I taught at two local colleges in health and well-being and sport, but I ran my own business, teaching exercise classes, lots of nice cheesy 80s aerobics and boxercise and things like that, but doing one-to-one personal training, again, very holistically, working primarily with women, looking at how we can maybe prioritise our health and well-being a little bit more, because what women tend to do is put ourselves at the bottom of a long list of other priorities. So I was making a difference in my own way. But Jo had said to me, oh, you should put yourself out there. You should stand for council. You should, you know, get involved. And I said, look, Jo, we've all got our own ways of making a difference. And I'm doing it my way and you're doing it your way. So I certainly wouldn't say that politics was on my agenda.
And then, of course, you have the event that we talked about, which is in 2016, the tragic murder of your sister. And to be honest, one of those things, I don't think you're ever going to get the words right, but at that point, is it fair to say everything just changes?
Oh, just, it's unbelievable. I mean, like, everybody experiences death, but when you lose somebody in such horrific circumstances, the shock is indescribable. And also, murder has got just a whole different level of, you know, emotional, just unbelievable trauma. And when it's, you know, like Jo was targeted, it was a political, you know, politically motivated murder. So all the layers of that, and then the public nature of it as well. I mean, we'd always been really clear when Jo was the MP, look, we will support you 100%, but we want to be in the background. We don't want anyone to know who we are. And then so suddenly you're thrust into that spotlight. Then you enter the judicial system, which I had no experience of. So all those different layers, and the impact that it had on our community, the impact it had nationally and internationally, actually. I mean, we were contacted by people from all over the world. So everything changed. And even though, you know, it's coming up to 9 years since Jo was killed, I know I haven't dealt with that. I haven't processed it. I've kind of just got my head down and tried to make a difference under those really difficult circumstances. But, it's unbelievable. And you meet other people who've lost loved ones in really dreadful circumstances. And you've kind of, I wouldn't blame anybody for just shutting up shop, you know, and I say that all the time. But also what you see is people finding a way to make a difference on the back of that tragedy. And that's, I guess, what we've tried to do as a family.
Completely. And in a way, what you're saying is why it's so remarkable, which is it's a politically motivated murder. of your sister who's an MP, and you are now an MP. Which is, well, it's everything you just said, which is, you know, trying to find something from that and taking that away. But one could forgive anyone for wanting to either, you know, box himself up, but particularly not go and do the same job.
Yeah, no, and you're right. As you said in your introduction, I mean, for 5 years, I didn't go anywhere near politics. And we worked through the Joe Cox Foundation. I worked at a local level in the community that I love. And I did those other things to try and make a difference. And there's probably many times I've said when I've spoken during that 5 year period that, you know, politics is not for me. And, you know, and actually, I guess I went on my own journey around the ways that you can make a difference. And what I knew in 2021, when the Batley and Spence seat became available, was we needed somebody local who understood our community, particularly because of the history and what we'd all been through as a community. And it was a huge decision to put myself forward, you know, and I've done everything I possibly can to be the best MP I possibly can be. But it's a tough job, and it was a huge decision.
And it's a strange one, in a way, because there's obviously so many people in Parliament who, from the age of about 4, maybe it's 2 if you're a Tory male, have, you know, been thinking about, I want to have my seat in Parliament.
Yep.
And then you're there through very unique circumstances. Mm. So do you enjoy the job? Is enjoy the wrong word?
Enjoy is definitely the wrong word.
Yeah.
Being an MP is a really tough job, and people don't want to hear that, but it is. If you do it properly and you do it well, it's challenging. And I think for me, I really want to do everything really, really well. And one of the challenges of the job is, because you are involved in so many different things, locally, nationally, internationally, it's very hard to give everything the full attention that it needs. And that's one of the things I do find really challenging. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Parliament is full of MPs with very different backgrounds and very different stories, but there are a lot of people there who it has been their life's dream to be in that place. And that certainly isn't my story. And I think that's a good thing, because I think you need people from different backgrounds, but also with different stories. I mean, we've got colleagues in the new Labour intake this time, and I've worked with a lot closely in recent months. You know, we've got doctors, we've got people who were lawyers, we've got people from the NHS background, you know, and everything in between. And I think that's a real strength, actually. But equally, you've got people who followed a very traditional political route, and that's also a good thing.
Oh, completely. Yeah, no, you don't want only former spats.
No.
But also, like, as in, you could see with the Labour selections, one of the things they did were, there were some people who'd been involved in the party a long time, but then they also had vaccine scientists becoming MPs, which, you know, just like the House of Lords, you want a mix, right?
Absolutely. I totally agree.
What would you say, I suppose, you know, talk about assisted dying, which obviously is dominating things as they are, but I know you came on previously a panel of some of your work on loneliness that you've been doing. So you enter Parliament, you never planned to be there. And did you start to think, how can I have some of the, I suppose, the things that you're passionate about, health, fitness, all those things, and bring that to my new life?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in opposition for the first 3 years of doing the job, I got involved in lots of all-party parliamentary groups, because the other thing I feel passionate about is cross-party working. I think that's something that the public like. I certainly enjoy that. So I was chair of the all-party parliamentary group for sport. I co-chaired the all-party parliamentary group with Tracy Crouch for loneliness and connected communities. So building on my own personal and professional experience, but also the work that I'd done at the Joe Cox Foundation around building connection and health and well-being, building healthy, strong communities, but also healthy, strong individuals. Because the agenda I think we need to really focus on is prevention and early intervention. And I produced a report in 2023 with the Fabian Society called Healthy Britain. And it was all about, if Labour did get into government, how we could embed health and wellbeing policy across every department. That's my real passion. And whatever happens with the bill that I'm currently working on, I really do hope to revisit that, because that's how I think you can see transformational change in politics and across the country.
And just, I suppose, to go back on the kind of entering about the background of some of your colleagues, have you had to get your head around the inner workings of Labour internal politics?
Yeah, I mean, you've got the Labour internal politics, you've got the parliamentary procedure and processes, and a lot of it is a bit antiquated and a bit bonkers. Yeah. So there's a lot to get your head around procedurally. I mean, I did 6 months in the whip's office. That was very helpful. I think actually every MP should probably have a stint at being a whip, because you learn a lot more about procedure.
Yeah, a lot about procedure, and also probably a bit about human nature.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, because I mean, that's a really important point actually, Katie, because I think as MPs, you're often dehumanised. You get those 2 letters after your name and people treat you differently. And actually, we've got a very important professional job to do, but we're all human beings as well. We've all got our own family dynamics going on. We've all got our staff who are just outstanding, and you can't do this job without having an amazing staff team. So you're managing lots of different dynamics through the role of being an MP, and your party have to manage those dynamics and Parliament has to manage those dynamics. So it's quite an interesting situation, really, probably, well, definitely like unlike any other business or organisation.
Now, given you haven't come in, you know, you didn't grow up thinking, I am Labour. Is there a Labour tribe you would put yourself in? Ooh. Or do you, you know, we have Blue Labour, we have the Blairites, we have the Brownites, we have the Stormtroopers. I'm probably getting this wrong. We could, you know, we could have a little communist camp at somewhere. Soft Labour, you do. Where do you see yourself sitting politically? Or is it that kind of thing of you're clearly not someone who doesn't want to be tribal?
Yeah, no, I'm not a tribal politician. I'm a very loyal person in terms of, you know, I chose to stand as a Labour MP, and I am a Labour MP, and I will work loyally within the party. But for me, within all those different groups that you've sort of talked about there, I speak to everybody. And I will happily have a conversation with someone who is probably very on the left of the party, and I'll happily have a conversation with someone who would be much more to the centre or to the right of the party. Because I think politics should be a broad church, both across parties, but also within parties, and that's a real strength. So what I try and do, whatever the issue is, I will try and speak to colleagues who've got all different viewpoints on it. And I think that's a really important thing to do. And then the broader point of that is across political parties. And as I said, the all-party parliamentary groups that I've worked on, you know, I've connected with people with shared interests. And I think that's a really important aspect of politics.
Are there any Labour veterans who particularly took you under their wing when you joined?
Oh, gosh. I mean, everybody was extremely kind. Again, I think because I came in because of my story and because there were lots of people who knew Joe, people were particularly kind. But also because I came in on a by-election. It's a strange one coming in on your own as opposed to coming in with a group of MPs. But people were very aware. And because of the significance of the Batley and Spen by-election, I think it's fair to say it was a turning point for the Labour Party in lots of ways. I was scooped up by lots of different people, you know, some of the grandees of the party, people like Harriet Harman and Margaret Hodge and people like that who've been around for a long time. But then colleagues who were friends with Joe, you know, Stephen Kinnock, who shared an office with Joe, and lots of people. And I think that's a real positive for me. I think most people within the Parliamentary Labour Party, for various different reasons. It's been interesting getting to know the new intake because there's lots of them. But yeah, I'm a team player, you know, and for me, knowing people and getting to know people is a really important part of this job.
Now, let's talk about a sister dying, because Keir Starmer's first couple of months in government have probably been dominated more by this bill, I would say, than any government legislation. It's had a lot of coverage, a lot of attention, a lot of views on it. When you put forward this as a private member's bill, were you quite braced for what would come next and is still happening?
I knew it would be hard. I knew it would be hard work. I knew it would be a very emotional subject to deal with. I probably didn't realise how much work would be involved, but that's fine because I'm a grafter. I knew there would be different views and opinions. I think, unfortunately, some of that has been unpleasant at times, and that is something I have struggled with. Some of the personal, you know, unpleasantness towards me, questioning my motives, that's really difficult to deal with. I'm fully respectful of the different range of views that there are on what is a really important subject. I'm also very clear that the law needs to change because the status quo is not acceptable. And that's what, you know, Keir's spoken about that. Other former DPPs, Directors of Public Prosecution, have spoken about that. You know, we've got a huge gap here, you know, that has to be solved. But I'm also very aware of the range of issues around safeguarding and getting that right as well. I think some people have tried to portray this change in the law as either about choice and autonomy and dignity or about safeguarding. And actually, it has to be about both. We have to solve the problems that exist. We have to give that choice to people that want the choice, but we have to do that in a very safe and measured way. And that's certainly the focus I've had in taking the bill through Parliament so far.
And you mentioned that motives point, because one of the things has been, oh, this is what Keir Starmer wants, and they're just getting a backbench MP to push through his agenda so he doesn't have to quite do it because it's quite difficult. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, hopefully having spent a little
bit
of time
mind?
With me now. Yeah. I'm a woman who has her own mind. No one told me to do this. No one said you should do this. It was a really big decision for me to do it. But I've done it because I think it is an issue of our time. the public support for changing the law is very, very significant. And our job as MPs is to represent our constituents and to represent the public. So for me, it was a personal decision to do it. You know, it's obviously very important that Keir, with his background, can see, you know, the issues that there are around the current situation. But there's huge cross-party support for it as well. I mean, that's what's also been very interesting. It crosses the political divide. And the private members' bill, and, you know, some people have been critical of the route, but this is the right route for an issue of conscience. It's the right route for an issue of this magnitude. And I make no apology for that. You know, and I'm incredibly proud, actually, of the work that we've done, particularly as we've just come to the end of the bill committee stage. It has been a huge amount of work, and MPs have taken it very, very seriously, quite rightly too. And whatever happens next, the other important thing actually just to say is that we've opened up the conversation about death and dying, and we're not very good at that in this country. We've opened up the conversation about what end-of-life care looks like. So there's so much to be proud of so far, and I really do hope the bill does pass, because I think there's a clear need for that. But all those other things are also important.
And you mentioned committee bill stage, which we've just gone through, and I think there's been lots of coverage, some in The Spectator. I think, you know, you had some MPs, I think, such as Rachel Maskell, saying that they wanted to be on the committee and they felt like they were stopped for being on the committee. Then you had, obviously, the change when it came to judges and approval there, which has been someone, I think your side has said that's actually, you know, a smart move for this reason, but then others say it's a watering down and so forth, rows about who has been giving evidence. I just want, looking back on this process, I think they had the Naz Shah thing about the, there's been lots going on. Looking back, is there anything that you would do differently when it comes to this process, the committee stage we've just gone through?
No, I don't think there is, to be honest, yeah. Katie. I mean, it's a really important part of the process, but the Bill Committee has done what the Bill Committee does. I mean, you know, this happens with every piece of legislation. Just because this is a private member's bill, the process is fundamentally the same. We have a range of views of the MPs on the committee, quite right too. You know, people said, oh, she's just going to put people on who agree with her. Well, clearly that isn't the case. We've had some really impassioned debates on important issues, including from people who are fundamentally opposed to a change in the law, you know, like Danny Kruger.
Is it fair to say you have more who are supportive, though, than against it on
the... Well, the Bill Committee represents the view of the House at second reading. So, it's absolutely fine that you would have a majority who support the change in the law, but also having those other voices. And people, again, on committee who maybe voted yes, with reservations, somebody like Marie Tidball, who was, you know, concerned about things from a disability perspective, and then others who voted no with reservations, somebody like Jack Abbott, you know, who again has been extremely constructive as a member of the Bill Committee in discussing and putting amendments forward. So the Bill Committee represented, I think, where Parliament was, in that they voted yes to take the bill to the next stage, but with a range of different views and opinions. And, you know, there's been some really important debates and discussions, and that's what Bill Committees do. You know, there was also the criticism, oh, nothing will change in Bill Committee, it'll all just be rushed through. Well, we've spent somewhere like 80 hours in committee, far more than most government bills, and we've taken, and I've taken, lots of amendments, and the changes have been made on the back of the evidence, on the back of contributions from colleagues, some on the committee and some amendments that have come in from colleagues who are not on the committee. That's the process, and it's a powerful process. And it's actually work that I'm very proud of.
I think one of those changes is this extension for implementing the bill if it passes. So it would be 2029.
Well, no. I mean, let's hope it's not. Right. The idea of changing the backstop, and it is a backstop. That's a really important point.
Look, I feel like I'm back at Brexit when you say backstop.
Yeah, sorry. Don't have flashbacks to that. We've erased those memories, hopefully. But, you know, the important thing is this is done as soon as it is safe and practicable to do so. And that's the important thing. And you're absolutely right. In terms of some of the changes that we've accepted through the committee, the idea of having an actual assisted dying commission run by a commissioner, a judge or an ex-judge with the multidisciplinary panels, that's an important change. It's an important safeguard. But it will take time to set that up. So we've got to give government time, if the bill passes, to set that up.
So I understand. It could be delayed to 2029, but it would depend really on if it was ready before that.
Yeah, I mean, if it's done in 2 years, that's great. And it will, the law will commence in 2 years. And I really hope it is done within 2 or 3 years. I hope it doesn't take 4 years to get it done. I've also put amendments forward, which would mean the commissioner has to be appointed within 12 months of the bill passing. So you would have the person who was leading the new structure. And then also 6 monthly reports to Parliament. progress reports, essentially, to say, right, what's happening? Because what we do not want, and I would be extremely upset about, would be if, you know, 4 years passes and suddenly someone goes, oh, we've forgotten about our sister dying. Absolutely not. This has to be done incrementally.
Yeah, and of course, the risk of 2029, you don't need me to tell you this, but of course, that could be when Labour have a general election.
Yeah.
And then if you have, you know, even a minority Labour government or something, you know, before you know it, it could be that all this work's been done and it doesn't quite carry.
Yeah, and that would be devastating. And let's think about, you know, the people this actually is about. It's terminally ill people, and it's people who want to have this choice. So we've got to bring it back to them all the time. And the longer this takes, the more people, sadly, will end up either taking their own lives out of desperation and fear, or having painful, traumatic deaths, or going to Switzerland if they can afford to do that. You know, those are the problems we've got to solve. And from my perspective, as long as we do it safely, we need to solve them sooner rather than later.
What do you say to some of the critics who will say, if you take Labour's agenda as a whole, so, some will look at the winter fuel allowance, some will look at the welfare cuts at the moment, just some measures, and then you bring in assisted dying. There is an argument being made by some that this almost, you know, it could be quite dangerous to throw assisted dying into the mix.
Yeah, no, I would disagree with that. I mean, look, we're all very clear that when we got elected, we inherited a mess on every level. You know, there's a lot of work to do and there's difficult decisions to be made by people in government. But I think some of the reform that we're looking at through the healthcare system and the NHS, that actually makes it the right time to put this change in, because we are looking at end-of-life care. We're looking at hospices and palliative care. We're looking at increasing efficiency. And that, for me, makes this the right time to have that conversation and to do that in a very holistic, joined-up way. So I would push back on saying it's the wrong time. And also remember, this debate has been going on for decades. It's not a new issue. And I think as part of that reframing of end-of-life care and choice, this is the right time to look at changing the law around assisted dying.
Now, if the vote passes and it starts to be implemented, of course, Wes Streeting and Shabana Mahmood, you know, two of the Secretaries of State who are in their briefs of Health Secretary and Justice Secretary, will play a key role in this. Both have spoken against the idea of it. Do you have full faith that they'll, you know, the right people to implement this if it gets to that point?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, Wes and Shabana are friends of mine. They're extremely professional people. And if it is the will of the House to change the law, you know, I have every confidence that they will do whatever they need to do that. We've also had two ministers sitting on the bill committee, Stephen Kinnock from Department of Health and Social Care and Sarah Sackman from MOJ, who have worked extremely hard, along with myself and government officials, you know, from a neutral position on the issue, but to make the bill workable and operable. So I have every confidence that that work would be done.
Final one, assisted dying for me. I mean, how are you feeling ahead of the vote, third reading?
I need to catch up on some sleep. Yeah. And then what we need to do is look at what happens with report stage and third reading, which is the next stage. Yes. I think my job now is to ensure that colleagues are aware of the changes that have been made to the bill. That's the bill that they'll be voting on, to have those conversations. Not my job to tell people how to vote. It's a vote of conscience, as indeed it should be. But just to make sure people are aware of the process that has been gone through, because there's a lot else going on in politics. People haven't been following it in the way that clearly I have. And just to have those conversations and say, look, this is your decision, but this is what it now looks like. These are the safeguards that have been added. These are the things that have been strengthened. And I do think, you know, people have got genuine concerns about, you know, things like safeguards. We'll take a look at the new bill as it's presented. And I think it'd be very difficult to say this is not a safe process. It will be the strongest piece of legislation in the world around assisted dying. I mean, there is, you know, an argument that says actually this is almost too difficult, because you've got terminally ill dying people who are going to have to jump through a lot of hoops. But I would say that is important. It's important the process is robust, but we'll have two doctors, potentially a compulsory psychiatric referral if there's any doubt about the patient's capacity. Then we'll go towards the panel with a social worker, a psychiatrist, a judge or a KC, all overseen by a high court judge or an ex-high court judge. That is a very thorough, robust process. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are fundamentally, ideologically opposed to assisted dying will ever vote for the bill. And I accept that and I'm respectful of that. But I think for colleagues who can see that the law needs to change, they will be presented with a very thorough piece of legislation.
And whatever happens, the point you made earlier was we started a debate.
Yeah.
And a conversation, yeah.
And that is really important. Whatever happens next, we've moved the conversation on around end-of-life care, end-of-life choice, and indeed death and dying.
Now, moving away from assisted dying, on well, it's not been the most lighthearted episode, but we're now more in the lighthearted section.
Good, that's good to hear.
Okay. I mean, how do you relax? Where do you get your breaks? Do you feel your family have seen you very much recently?
Yeah, I don't relax at the moment and I don't get any breaks at the moment, but that is going to change. It's going to have to change. I think because I'm such a sort of 100% person, if I'm doing something, I'm doing it properly. And I have literally lived and breathed the bill for the past 6 months or so. I want to pick up the other issues that I care about. I want to pick up the health and wellbeing agenda, my passion for sport, the thing around the issues around loneliness and social cohesion and connection, all those other things that I feel passionately about. And I will do that. I would also, as you said, I'd quite like to see my friends at some point and my partner and my family. But it's a hard job to get that balance. And it is a really hard job. We work very long hours. You've got your constituency work with your parliamentary work, and it's difficult. But, you know, if I go back to my previous career around health and wellbeing, you know, women particularly put ourselves at the bottom of a long list, and I need to maybe practice what I preach a little bit more and find a bit of me time at some point.
And you obviously had the first career, you're onto the second career. Can you imagine a third career?
Retirement.
Yeah, okay, that's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what comes next, you know. I don't know how long I'll be an MP for. There's, as I've said previously, there's different ways of making a difference. And I think I'll always try and do something to make a difference. And then, yeah, maybe retire soon.
And now Labour are in government. I mean, how have you found that transition? Because, of course, you get to do things, but also, you know, we're recording on the week of the spring statement and, you know, waking up to front pages accusing, you know, Rachel Reeves of being a Tory and so forth, and the compromise that comes with government.
Massive change. I mean, I did 3 years as an opposition MP. I spent huge amounts of time in my constituency. I did a lot of local work, a lot of local projects and initiatives. And literally after the election, it's like it just changed the pressure, the intensity. Because you go from a position of saying, which is where the Tories are now, saying you should be doing this, you should be doing that. And then suddenly you go, oh my gosh, it's us and we've got to sort this out and there's a lot to sort out. So the pressure is much more intense. I feel that on a personal level and I feel it obviously as the party of government. It's tough and there's some tough changes and to be made and there's tough challenges ahead. But, you know, we've got some good people in politics. That doesn't mean that, you know, these decisions are easy and we'll do everything we can, but I think it will take time. And the problem you've got now is we have a society and a culture where people want quick answers and quick solutions to things. And when you're dealing with complex problems and, you know, if we're honest, problems that have been embedded for a number of years, you know, your prisons don't suddenly get full. You don't suddenly end up with a crisis in special educational needs. You don't suddenly end up with the social care crisis that we've got. This has taken, you know, over a decade to get to that point. And we are not going to be able to fix it overnight. I really wish we could. So there's a lot of hard work to do.
Two final questions. Batley and Spen by-election. Obviously, it was a tough fight.
I've had more fun, yep.
How do you see the rise of reform now and the threat that reform posed Labour?
I think in terms of reform, I think the move there is symptomatic of, I think, disillusion with politics. And that really worries me. Disillusion with the establishment, whatever you perceive the establishment to be. And I think that's about how we can reconnect with people around politics and show them, as you know, as my sister sort of showed me, that politics is about people, it's about making a difference. And I think we've got some work to do in that regard, across the political spectrum, actually, I would say. Maybe part of that is one of my other passions is political education. We don't teach people about politics in schools enough. We don't teach adults enough about how politics works. You know, as an MP, your inbox is full of stuff, which a lot of it is not the work of an MP. It could be council work. It could be police matters. There's lots of things that, you know, people get in touch with you about because we've never really explained to them what an MP does and what they can't do. And I think political education in schools is something that we really need to look at focusing on. We also need to look at how we behave as politicians. You know, this is a really privileged job and it should be treated as such. And if we see behaviour, you know, which is inappropriate, if we see people shouting at each other and, you know, that doesn't do any of us any favours. I think there's the role around journalism as well. You know, some of the coverage on the assisted dying bill has been inaccurate. It's not been balanced. And that worries me on such an important issue. And we sadly see that all the time. So I think we need responsible politicians and we need responsible journalism. We need better political education. And that will hopefully try and build more trust in the system and in us as individuals. And also, like you're doing with this interview, showing MPs as actual people and human beings. But there's a lot of work to do, I think, to rebuild trust and faith in politics.
Yeah, otherwise protest parties start to flourish.
Exactly, yeah. And people are pushed towards the extremes and that becomes dangerous.
Final question, when we ask everyone on this podcast, which is, what is the worst advice you've ever been given?
The worst advice I've ever been given? Have you thought about being an MP? Probably. Yeah, which came from various quarters and I did push back on it a bit, but yeah. No,
push back,
I
mean, for a while.
Yeah, I pushed back for a while as long as I could. And I'm kind of saying that a little bit flippantly. You know, however long I end up being an MP for, I'll do my very best. I'll work as hard as I possibly can. There's probably some bad advice in the 80s about perms as well.
Yeah.
If I think about it, I probably had a perm for maybe about 5 or 10 years too long.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was probably not the best.
I want to see a photo now.
But yeah, oh, the hair just got bigger and bigger and bigger. I think, and anybody who's a similar age to me probably went through that experience as well. But yeah, look, I'm always open to advice. I think that's the other thing, isn't it? We don't have all the answers and we should be open to advice.
Thank you, Kim, for joining the podcast today.
Thank you very much.